This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hey everybody, welcome to Best Show Bests, the best of the best show. And you can find out more about the best show over at thebestshow.net. It airs live every Tuesday night from 9 p.m. to midnight Eastern Standard Time. And if you're new to the program, this show, these are little bite-sized bits and greatest hits type samples of what we do every week. So if you like this, maybe you check out the full show. And if you want to support The Best Show, we have a Patreon set up over at patreon.com/thebestshow. That is how you support the program. It is listener-sponsored now, and you give what you can, and we appreciate it. And there are prizes and benefits at all different levels of giving. So again, go to patreon.com/thebestshow and support the show. And now please, without further ado, check out this episode of Best Show Bests. Is Bob Mayer here, Mike? He left. What?
Yeah, I'll let him.
He left. All right.
All right.
How are you? I'm good. Dudio's here tonight. Thank you, Dudio.
I don't know if they make the guaparito locally yet, but I'm looking into it.
He's looking. Oh. That might be the most depressing thing I've ever heard.
They have the Whopper dogs, though.
The Whopper dogs. Oh, they're hot. The Whopper hot dog?
Yeah, they're Whopper hot dogs.
Have you had one yet?
I haven't.
No. Mike? Mike?
Yeah.
Have you had a Whopper hot dog?
No, I haven't. Oh, no, I did. Somebody brought
it
to the bar.
That is... I strike when I said that was the most depressing thing I've ever heard, that you were going to look into where the Whopperito was. The fact that Mike forgot he had a Whopper hot dog and then remember, oh yeah, I did. I forgot. Someone brought one into the bar. Bob Mayer, how are you?
I'm good, Tom. How are you?
I'm good. I'll be even a little better if you get up on that.
A little bit closer.
There it is. Look, I do this all day long. You live with your fingers and your computer.
No, I do it all longhand. And
oh, you do?
No,
and then,
of course
then
not.
You send it off.
Right.
I
call for the copy boy to come take the copy.
Yes, to take it away. And then it's always like you hear about these writers. You hear like, Aaron Sorkin writes everything out on a pad. It's like, all right. There's a point where that's super affected. It's just like, try a computer. Just try it.
It won't hurt you.
Yeah. Just see if it works. We're just asking to give it a shot once. Try a computer and see if you can write on it. Not the pad.
David Milch, he just lays down on some kind of mat and just talks extemporaneously and comes up with the stuff. And he has two people typing it and others recording it in case they miss anything.
So he's got that. And then I'm waiting to hear about somebody where it's just like, oh, yeah, Quentin Tarantino writes his stuff like the Flintstones. He has a bird pecking it into a stone. But you wrote this book, Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements. And I want to just say, first of all, this is the cover of the book. That's really.
Oh, wait,
the dust jacket's not on it. I was going to say... It's an ominous cover, everyone. It's pitch black, and it says nothing on it. And then I realize, oh, it's a hardcover book, and I took the dust jacket off. But this book...
Yes, sir.
I've read rock books, my whole life. And I'm telling you, this book is way... This is one of the all-time greatest rock books ever read.
That's very kind of you to say, even if it's not true.
It's totally true. And it's almost 500 pages. It's so well researched, but it's not academic. And you tell the story and you let everybody, whether they sink or swim, it depends on where they were at. You really struck the balance with it, Bob.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I had enough time. I spent about 8 years working on it, so I figured if I was going to spend that long, I might as well try and get it right, get that balance right.
Get the balance right, another Depeche Mode song.
Yes.
That we mentioned, which one did Neil Haggerty mention earlier? A New Life?
Yeah.
Now love, not loving itself. Get the balance right. What about that as the next book, Depeche Mode? What do you think?
Well, it's funny you say that. We have run into a couple of their tour managers or people mm-hmm. who work with them. They're all sort of English people who have mm-hmm. Seem like they're from a Guy Ritchie film for the most part for some reason. They're sort of Cockney gangster times.
Yeah.
So that would be interesting as a starting
point. Yes, as you get the real story from Andy Fletcher. So anyway, we're not talking about Depeche Mode now. We're talking about The Replacements.
Can I say, I noticed you had a, outside here in your palatial studios, noticed you had a photo autographed picture of John Fogerty, mm-hmm. and it reminded me of the time I interviewed John Fogerty. I mm-hmm. met him at a home that he owned. It wasn't the home he resided in, but it was a home.
Okay.
And I showed up, and you know John Fogerty has his own branded Pendleton shirts that he sort of okay. sells at shows. And I showed up, and the publicist who met me there was wearing one of his shirts.
Mm-hmm.
And then John Fogerty's brother came in wearing one of his shirts, mm-hmm. and John Fogerty came in wearing one of his shirts. So they all were wearing his Pendleton branded shirts.
Okay.
And it reminded me of the situation you have now with Mike and his Masses shirts. Everybody
yeah.
has one on.
Oh. Look, this is going to be the lowest point. This guy, first of all, he's whatever he did to get you to drop the Masses shirts in this. Mike, you did it. Congratulations, Mike. You did it. You got Bob to mention. He's here to talk about his book. You got him plugging your dumb shirts again. Yeah. This guy worked 8 years on a book. He finally gets to tell the world about it, but you're out there browbeating him into mentioning your T-shirt. Let him talk about Trouble Boys, the true story of The Replacements. Now, this book, you know what's amazing about this book to me, Bob Mayer?
Yes.
Is one of the things that was amazing about it is it's like you captured the sense of, like the it's like a story of class to me in so many ways, where it's like these dudes are like they're not supposed to be anything,
right?
They're just like born to just, like they say, to like push a broom or to push a mop. And it's just like the idea that you could get four guys who have like a larger calling in some one way or another, and that these four guys manage to just unite when people aren't looking for guys like that to do that.
Sure.
Like that's not what they're there to go get job. They didn't finish high school, right?
Right. Yeah, Westerberg's joke was there wasn't a high school diploma or a driver's license between the four of them, which is, you know, he wasn't exaggerating. It's mm-hmm. true. So if you're a band and that's your starting point, it's hard just to get to gigs, you know.
Yeah. But the idea of being able to do something that's so honest and pure and beautiful as The Replacements did through their run, when you're still feeling the pull of the of where what you came from and what your parents came from and what their parents came from,
yeah.
It's like it's really insane to think that it would even happen in a way.
Yeah, and it is the funny thing. It's by all rights they shouldn't have gotten to 1981, much less, you know, 12 albums and or 8 albums and 12 years later, and here we are 30 years later, and they've, you know, on the reunion tour they're packing arenas and stadiums and that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, the first part of the book is called Jail, Death, or Janitor, which is what Westerberg's answer was when he was asked, you know, what your life would have been if this band hadn't come along. And if it hadn't been this exact, you know, grouping of four people equally desperate and hoping to kind of transcend their limitations. And Jail, Death, or Janitor. And for him, you know, he was a janitor. So Janitor in that sequence comes after Jail and Death. But
yeah. And but even no matter how much they succeed,
right,
they still can't shake the sense that none of this is going to work out.
Yeah. And, you know, part of that was this, that's the psychology, and that's the way they were thinking the whole time. And the way that came out, it was the thing of fear. It was fear of failure, but also fear of success. And that was the sort of guiding principle of everything they did, all the outrageous things with record companies and producers and even with their own fans. And so, yeah, it becomes this story of people who are saddled with these great expectations and are in this industry and show business, and they're totally ill-equipped emotionally and psychologically to succeed, yet everybody's trying to push them towards this kind of, you know, conventional success. And they're bucking that the whole time. And so that creates a pretty amazing tension that in their case carried on for a decade plus.
But they're also, they're doing that tug, that push me, pull me thing,
right,
where they'll lash out against what somebody else has telling them to do. They'll buck the status quo with a thing, and then they'll just be like, why aren't we as big as REM?
Right. Well, yeah. And that was the interesting thing in researching the book, and I did it with the cooperation of Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson and most of the key principals. It's like finding out, particularly for the band, how competitive they were. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not something you'd normally associate or commonly associate with the Replacements. But they were super competitive early on with bands in Minneapolis like Husker Du or The Suburbs. And later on, REM became kind of their rivals or their perceived rivals, even though they were, you know, friendly on the surface. But, yeah, it's a weird thing of go away but love me, you know, that push and pull. And yeah, I mean, I think a lot of bands have that to an extent, but these guys had it at such a high level, and it was so deep in their DNA that it became the story. You know, it was more almost their career was less about the music or commercial decisions. It was just like trying to get them to not just cooperate, but sort of be part of their own career.
Yeah. Hey, we got Bob Mayer here. He wrote Trouble Boys, The True Story of the Replacements, which is a really great book that came out. When did this come out? A month and a half ago?
March 1st of March. So it's been out about 3 months.
3 months then. Month and a half. Six Rounding. Weeks, 12 weeks. I don't know. Look, I got it in the mail. I didn't stare at that. I wasn't unpacking boxes at Barnes & Noble and saw, it's here now. And people seem to really be responding to the book.
Yeah, I think I was lucky that they did the reunion for a couple of years and raised their profile and then sort of abruptly disappeared. And so the book was kind of waiting for the fan base and all the people who were curious about them. And that was not entirely planned on my part, but it worked out. So
this 8-year thing, one day you're just like, I know what I'll do. Because you must have known that's like, it's one of the most, the bar is so high or low. What is the bar? If you're doing limbo, it's low.
Low, yeah. And if
but it's high and if you're doing, if you're pole vaulting.
Yes.
Let's just say you're pole vaulting. The bar is so high on making this happen. Like, you just know, because it's a band that the cult is so
strong. And
yeah. And if that book is wrong, you're gonna hear it.
Yeah. Every Replacements fan and diehard and nerd and whatever you want to say is like, they do have a very intense and intensely devoted following, and it's not really sort of, I guess there are some, but most Replacements fans don't fall into the casual category. They're very, as I say, hardcore. And, you know, also I was given the opportunity because the band was participating, so it's like sort of they were putting a lot of faith in me, and I think mostly after, you know, I thought it would take a couple years, but after the third year and the fourth year and the fifth year and the sixth year, and it hadn't quite resolved itself or gotten finished. I think even they were having their doubts. Their their A&R guy, Michael Hill, who's a Jersey native, was telling me. I asked him, we both the other night, we did an event in Hoboken, and I asked him, I said, were you concerned that this might not actually, you know, that I might screw it up? What did you really think? He's like, I just didn't think it was ever coming out. I started to wonder if you were actually some sort of weird grifter who was
just collecting stuff. And then that somebody would have ended up being like, I'm going to write a replacements book. They'd be like, go, this guy did a whole lot of work on it. Just go get his, he started the ball. Tell him that we told him to give you all the stuff he worked on and all the transcriptions of the interviews.
For the last 9 years.
Yeah. So what would be the low point in terms in the, this thing, if just of that? Because that is such, 8 years is to see a thing through.
Well, there's always the point, this is being my first book as well, there's always a point where you wonder, like, okay, you know, you're doing the research and you can do the interviews and read up and all that stuff. There's a point where you sort of have to set pen to paper. Or if you're Aaron Sorkin, you know, quill to scroll. Or
sure,
whatever.
Yes.
I mean, there was a point where it's like you can sort of almost avoid doing the actual writing, which you may know something about, by just distracting yourself with everything on earth, and including the research and the sort of what you're perceiving as prep work. But, you know, at some point you have to start doing it. And I actually started with the chapter kind of in the middle of the book. I thought, well, if I can write this piece of their history, which was when they tried to make a record up in Bearsville that sort of turned into a Shining type nightmare in the woods. So I thought, if I can write that, then I can do it. And so that was sort of the litmus test and the challenge. And there was a couple points just getting through that, that I thought, if I can get through this, I can write it. But there was moments where I thought, well, maybe I won't. But once I did, then it was sort of all downhill or up.
Yeah. See, again, bars high, bars low, downhill, uphill. Guys, we got to lock these metaphors down and stick to one.
Tighten them up.
Yeah, let's tighten up the metaphors. So the band was involved. You spent a lot of time talking to Paul Westerberg and Tommy Stinson. Chris Mars was less
forthcoming. I made efforts with everybody, but he was the only one who really sort of sat it out. But I had interviewed him a bit before I actually started the project in earnest. Doing I did a long story for Spin back in 2008. But yeah, and it was, you know, with Bob Stinson having passed away in 95, I didn't have access to him. So you still have to do the work and kind of build the characters and make them three-dimensional and flesh out their stories, even if they're not, you don't have the same kind of access as I did to Paul and Tommy. But, you know, dealing with Paul and Tommy was sort of an adventure in itself, you know, going up to see them and dealing with all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it was, you know, somebody was asking me outside, like, you know, what was that experience like? And it was good, but I also found I had these weird experiences because I interviewed a couple hundred people, including, like, you know, at one point I was interviewing the guy who sold merch for them. Who's a really good guy, who's Jimmy Velvet, as he's known, and he's John Cafferty's cousin of Beaver Brown Band fame. But he works with Morten Andersen, the kicker, the NFL kicker, who was, like, Swedish Hall of Fame. So at one point I was interviewing him, and we went out with Morten Andersen. So I'm, like, in suburban Atlanta, Georgia, trying to explain to the Swedish NFL kicker what the replacements are. You know? So it's like it took me a lot of places you wouldn't normally expect in a rock and roll book.
And when you finally say, I think we're near the end, and then you have this book, which is such a – Such a roller coaster type book, because there's a point when you're reading this and it's just like you just want to wring their necks and you just want to go like, stop drinking. You just want to go, it might go easier if you guys aren't drunk this morning. Like, you just want to scream at them, like, why is this recording session not working? You're drunk.
Yes, or on some sort of horse tranquilizer.
Yeah, exactly. It is amazing also how when you think of bands when they go into the studio, and it's like Fleetwood Mac and like these bands that just like, we'll figure it out in the studio. And like you grow up and it's like this, you're into a certain kind of music where that seems like it's the absolute opposite of how your favorite bands operate, right. Where it's just like, where you'd be like, no, the bands I like go in, and 3 days later, they have an album.
Right.
But isn't it amazing how it just happens, and suddenly a band is as kind of like rooted and raw as these guys. It's like you turn around and like 8 years later, it's just like they're like, the sessions in the one place didn't work.
Right.
We'll pick it back up and do it somewhere else
right.
next month.
Right. It's like they made Stink in one afternoon in 1982. And then like 7 years later, they're going to Bearsville and Capitol and Cherokee and Paisley Park to make one record. It's like,
yeah.
I think part of that, some of that was the era. By the time you get to the major labels, there was, especially back then when budgets were big, and there was almost expectation if you didn't spend $500,000, what kind of record are you giving us? If it, you know,
sure.
So
it's that thing. Yeah, it's that thing where it just clearly is expected to be. And just the idea of the budget for that video.
Right.
How much was the budget for the Bastards of Young video?
Well, that was, yeah, I can't remember.
Even that one was like, because.
Right.
Like, look, if that budget was more than $450, it's extraneous.
I think that – I don't remember if I included it in the book, but the head of the – one of the – their product manager or one of the executives of the label came and it's like, there's nothing going on in the video. It's the shooting a speaker, but they said like in between shots they were sort of like art directing the speaker. It was like they were
– Yeah, let me tell them something about directing videos. But yeah, it really, you finish the book and then at some point this very intense up and down story, you have to say, Paul Westerberg, I'd like to, send you a copy of the book. Like, what was that like?
Funny you should ask, Tom. So the whole time I was writing the book, typically he at least gives the impression he doesn't read his press and mm-hmm. didn't want to read the finished book before it came out.
Okay.
Not surprisingly, at the last minute, he changed his mind and wanted to see a galley, which I had printed just before we were going into the production on the actual book. So.
And now suddenly you're like...
yeah. Like Lou Costello as I wait.
Like, hey, Meg, a galley. He wants the galley. I guess.
So I thought, okay, well, I'll send you a galley. And I FedExed it to make sure he got it. And of course, I had the tracking number to make sure he was going to get it.
Uh-huh.
And I check the delivery on a Saturday morning. Uh-huh. And it's like, okay, he's got the book. He signed for it.
Yeah. And right. you just, how was that weekend?
Yeah, that weekend was terrific. And it got even better that night. I didn't hear from him. Yeah, I figured, well, he's going to take a few days to read it or whatever.
Yeah.
About 3 o'clock that morning, my phone starts ringing. Mm-hmm. Cell phone starts ringing.
Give me the ringer. First, let's get some context here. What ringer do you have, Bob Mayer? Is it – let me see if I can guess what ringer you have. Does it go like Tony Soprano?
No. No. I did have that at one point.
Does it go – is it the xylophone?
Yes.
It was.
Yeah, so
– 3 in the morning. Arguably the worst cell phone sound of all the cell phones available. The ringer, the xylophone goes off. You look, and what do you have him entered in as?
My hero. The best. The best part is I've sent the thing. I don't expect to hear from him. I'm not going to let it ruin my weekend. It's a beautiful. It's right before Christmas, actually.
Okay. Yeah. Oh, what a great. Yeah.
I decide I'm going to go to the gym. I go play basketball. Have a nice lunch. Mm-hmm. Probably went to the movies. I was
when
with
you're playing basketball.
Yes.
Not to take it off target.
Sure.
Where do you what kind of player are you like?
I play well.
Zach Randolph.
No, I'm much more like Steve Novak. I would say
Steve Novak. So you are hurt.
I'm hurt, and I shoot 3-pointers alternately, basically.
So you're on the IR. You show up at the playground.
Yeah.
On the injured list.
So
now the phone rings. It's 3 in the morning.
3 in the morning. And I do have his number, but his number generally comes up unknown. But it's a very specific type of unknown number. So basically, it's like its own form of caller ID. Mm-hmm. So I know who it is. And I remember hearing the phone ring, turning over in bed, looking at the phone, sort of sighing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was in a fog. I was deep asleep. But instantly that sound, you know, and when I realized it wasn't my, you know, somebody, a family member calling mm-hmm. with an emergency, and I realized it was unknown, mm-hmm. Probably the terror was even greater. Mm-hmm. And I turned to my then fiance, about to be my wife, and I just said, well, that's not good.
Yeah.
He left a voicemail.
Okay.
And it, as you imagine, the guy having read a 500-page book about his life in such detail, most of it occurring in his 20s, mm-hmm. was probably a bit of a mind warp for him. Mm-hmm. And I think he was unsettled by the experience, let's say, initially. Okay. And so his voicemail was reflective of that. Mm-hmm. So suffice to say, I didn't get back to bed, mm-hmm. But I let it go to voicemail. Yeah. I figured I'll call him in the morning.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
Sleep was unsettled that evening, Tom.
Yeah. But then when you finally get on the horn with him.
Yes, I get on the horn with him. So I called and left a proper message in the morning. He screened his calls. He didn't answer. I said, hey, you know, I heard you got your voicemail. And I said, call me back. Happy to talk. Mm-hmm. And then actually I went back and played basketball the second day, trying to sort of burn some of this adrenaline that had been coursing through my body for the last 10 hours.
Yeah. You're trying to burn off the unburnable at this point.
And I saw the phone ring. I had kept it because I figured he was going to call back. And so that, standing in my shorts and high tops outside, mm-hmm. I had about a 2-hour conversation with him where he expressed, I wouldn't say displeasure, but discomfort with some of the things we talked about. Mm-hmm. And our arrangement always from the beginning was that it was, even though they were participating, it was technically unauthorized. It was my book to write. They didn't have editorial control. But, you know, mm-hmm. at the same time, you worry what somebody's response is going to be in that situation. So we went over it a couple hours. There were some tough moments in there. But ultimately, he was like, well, I got to go make dinner. I got to go have dinner. So mm-hmm. I mean, that was it. You know, he expressed some very positive things about the book. And I just think, I don't know about you, but I wouldn't want anybody bringing that sort of forensic detail to my life, particularly if my life in my 20s.
No. But, I don't want any.
No, sorry about that. Oh,
sorry. What's that?
Sorry, I'm sweeping up.
You're sweeping up?
Yeah, I'm the maintenance guy here. Uh-huh. With the current tower.
I don't...
I'll let you guys go.
No, wait.
It's a radio show? What's going on here?
Yes, this is a radio show. Oh. Yeah.
What are you talking about?
The Replacements. This is Bob Mayer. He wrote a Replacements book.
Oh, hey.
Called Trouble Boys.
Oh, should ask him why Asking Me Lies wasn't the follow-up to I'll Be You.
What?
What's that?
Guys.
Wait,
come back. Hey.
What's it?
Why don't you... Why don't you come back?
Busy.
No, come on back.
I was curious. I was wondering
what was that question?
Oh, I was wondering why Asking Me Lies wasn't the follow-up to I'll Be You. I know Aching to Be was the next video, and I think Back to Back went to radio, but none of them really caught fire.
Wait,
I think Asking Me Lies would have done great.
Why don't you have a seat? Have a seat, buddy. Steve? You said Steve?
Yeah.
Have a seat.
This is...
You guys are in the middle of doing something.
No, sit down.
No, wait.
Sit down.
Wait, how did you... That's interesting that you, a random maintenance man here, would be aware that... In fact, you were saying you thought Asking Me... He's talking about the Replacements' third major label album, Don't Tell a Soul, mm-hmm. the first single, which was I'll Be You. Mm-hmm. And he was asking why Asking Me Lies wasn't the follow-up to mm-hmm. that.
Right.
Which,
seems logical to me.
Yeah, that's pretty deep, though.
Yeah. Steve, can you get on that mic?
Oh, yeah,
a little more?
Yeah. How's that? So you have a book?
Yeah, it's about a 500-page book of the Replacements, biography of the Replacements called Trouble Boys. It's done really well. I'm surprised you haven't...
You ran down Trouble Boys.
Yeah.
So you talk to all kinds of people?
Yeah, I spent about 8 years doing interviews, researching the book. I had access to the band. I did almost 300 interviews.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
Talk to Paul Stark?
Yes, I talked to Paul Stark, the co-owner of Twin Tone Records, many times. Yeah.
How about Tom Byrne?
You're saying you haven't read my book, but you're aware of who Tom Byrne is?
Oh, yeah.
Well, yeah, Tom Byrne was the original or one of the original lead singers in the band that became the Replacements. Dog Breath.
Yeah. But before that, he was an oat with Paul.
Yeah, how... You're saying you really haven't read my book and you're aware of all this stuff?
Oh, yeah.
Because
you talk to Bugs?
Bugs.
Yeah.
Who's Bugs?
Tom Petty's guitar tech.
Oh.
Oh, Bugs Wydell. Yeah, I did actually talk to him kind of towards the end of the... Yeah, that's interesting. I'm okay.
Scott McCoy?
Sure, of the Young Fresh Fellows. Of course I talked to Scott McCoy.
He shared many stages.
A lot of drunken nights, I guess. What about Denny Carlson?
Denny Carlson. Oh, yeah. Well, so Thomas was in the early part of the book. There was a guy who was passing by the Replacements rehearsal who they never met, didn't know, was just heard the band playing. And he told them, suggested that they give their demo tape to Peter Jesperson at Twin Tone, who eventually signed them and became their manager. I didn't actually know his last name was Denny. Neither did the band. How did you, Carlson, we only had the first name. How did you know his last name was Denny Carlson?
Oh, well, Denny ended up here in Newbridge. Yeah, he ended up managing Scums, which, of course, was the Quin Cities only punk rock clothing store. You talked to Mike Anderson? I'm sorry, Detective Mike Anderson.
Detective Mike Anderson. I interviewed a lot of people, but that name doesn't ring a bell.
Oh, he's the officer, at the top of the stink EP before kids won't follow.
Oh, sure.
You know, he says, yeah. Everybody grab yourself and go, and no one goes to jail.
Yeah.
Yeah, I didn't know the officer had it. I mean, I researched this for almost a decade, but I didn't. I guess I'd talk to you beforehand.
What about Jeff Sorensen?
Who is Jeff Sorensen? Are these?
Jeff Sorensen, that is the guy who was, I didn't talk to him, but I believe that's who was the hand model on the cover of Please to Meet Me, shaking hands with Paul Westerberg. You know, he was representing the record. How do you?
You didn't talk to him, though.
No. Oh. I didn't talk to
him. Hmm. So these are,
But the book's good?
Well,
I think the book's great.
Okay. That's what people say, have been saying. It's got a lot of nice reviews.
I mean, what would you hope that the other hand model from the cover of Please to Meet Me would say in an interview about getting his hand photographed?
I don't know. I just thought he'd have some good insight into, you know, the dimensions of Paul's sleeve rip. You know, did that play into anything? You know, just questions anybody would ask, really. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, you know, it's as comprehensive as I could make it, I guess.
It's a very well researched book.
Huh. Did you talk to anybody here in Newbridge about it?
No. You know, I mean, I talked to a lot of folks, a lot of cities, a lot of clubs. The Replacements obviously were played, but Newbridge didn't come up in my research, and I did have access to a lot of people, a lot of road documents, but I couldn't explore all of them. Let's say that
I asked because that they played here all the time.
I mean, I knew they came through Jersey a lot, but I don't, you know,
yeah, they used to play this place called Los Amigos. Well, you know, Los Amigos is still a functioning Mexican restaurant, but they used to have a stage in the back, and they played all the time. They played a lot of cool shows there. A lot of bands play there: Husker Du, Let's Active, Mother 13, Rumpelstiltskin, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers?
No, Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers.
So Tom, comma
Patty.
Patty.
And the Heartbreakers. Yeah.
Was that? For some reason, I'm just picturing a band. If they're going to call themselves that, was there anybody else up there other than Tom and Patty?
No.
So
sometimes they'd have a dog.
So he would be called
the Heartbreakers.
A dog was known as.
Well, I know of a guy who had a dog named Rollins Band.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I always thought that was a cool name for a pet.
It is. Yeah.
Rollins Band.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So Tom, comma, Patty, and the Heartbreakers, which is a dog.
Yeah.
They played at Los Amigos.
They did. They were like an early scum rock band.
Okay.
Yeah. Do you know how Kurt Vile plays scum rock?
I don't know if he plays scum rock so much as...
No, he plays scuzz rock. You're right.
Okay. I didn't know... What's the difference between scum and scuzz rock?
Scuzz is a little more cigarette smoked.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so Kurt plays scuzz. I didn't know call what he does scuzz rock.
Yeah. But look, I'm getting far off topic here.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, there's that I'm sure this is in your book. The day that the Replacements have to leave Tommy Stinson behind in New York.
Sure, that was in '83. They, I guess, Tommy was
they got separated at some point, and this is before call waiting and cell phones, and so they had a gig in Boston, and they couldn't get a hold of Tommy, and so they just left him and played the gig in Boston, and then came back and picked him up.
Mm-hmm. What's rarely reported about that story is that they actually played Newbridge on the way back before picking up Tommy.
Huh. Okay.
And I played bass.
You played bass?
I did, yeah. Wow. Yeah.
Because he was, because Tommy got left behind.
Exactly, yeah.
You played bass.
They needed some money, you know, mm-hmm. to keep the tour going. So they stopped at Los Amigos and played a pickup show, and I sat in on bass, and they loved me.
Really?
Oh, yeah. They said I was the best ever. Better than Tommy. And they said I'd actually be in the band if I wasn't 4'8" and albino.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm. Thank you guys for not mentioning that when I came in.
No, I didn't even notice. I was just looking at your hat.
It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's it say on that?
Well, it's a sombrero.
Yeah, but it's got a little, like an iron-on on it.
It does,
looks
yeah.
like it says, keep on, oh, that's not trucking. I can't say what that says.
No. It's, but you can say what's above it, though. Ariba.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Undulate.
And keep on bleeping.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which I do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. So is that like one of your, is that like a words to live by for
it is.
You?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It served me well when I was in the hut.
The hut?
Yeah.
Jail?
Yeah.
You were in jail?
Yeah. We don't need to get into it.
No. I would find that interesting.
Well, I was selling black market CDs at the Newbridge swap meet, and Officer Harrops nailed my ass.
Black market?
Yeah.
What do you mean by black market?
Well, you know what bootlegs are, right?
Yes.
Well, I was selling bootleg copies of the Weather Report album, Black Market.
Weather Report, yeah. That kind of jazz.
Joe Zawinul.
Uh-huh.
You know Joe Zawinul?
I don't know him personally, but
oh, you don't?
I'm aware of his body of work.
You know, he wears a beanie.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Would that be a book? Maybe your next book? If you're trying to think. You're right there?
Yeah, Steve? I am. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Beanie Boys, the Joe Zawinul story.
My wallet.
Uh-huh.
I have a lead wallet.
That was a very heavy wallet.
It's made of lead, but I've got a lot of money in it, too. Mm-hmm.
So you go around with a lot of money.
I do, yeah. I'm the Gene Simmons of night sweepers.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
A Weather Report, to follow this up?
Yeah.
Weather Report biography, spend the next 8 years working on that?
Yeah, I don't know that my passion for that sort of fusion jazz runs quite that deep to commit to it, but you know, you're piquing my interest.
Well, do one on Return to Forever then.
Oh, well, now that sure, that's a possibility.
Okay, yeah. So I got caught, right?
Mm-hmm.
And Judge Davies sentenced me to 2 months.
Okay.
But when I heard the whooshing followed by the dull thud under his robe, you know.
Because for...
I asked him if his pant pump was out of oil, and then he sentenced me to 10 years cruel labor.
Cruel labor,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah. That's the same as hard labor, but they make you break the rocks with a pool noodle. You know those pool noodles?
Yeah, those are the things that people, they're like floaties,
yeah.
Kind of, like people can float on in a pool.
Yeah. Yeah.
So how many rocks did you break with that pool noodle?
Like one. In 10 years.
In 10
yeah,
years.
Yeah.
Well, that, I thought you were going to say zero.
Well, see, I did. I surprised you. I did all right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I did a lot of cool things when I was in jail.
Mm-hmm. Like what other things?
Well, I don't know if I can say it's on the air, but you know how prison guys give each other tattoos?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I have a tattoo.
Okay.
It's on my wimple.
Ugh.
And
no,
and it says Gary.
Mm-hmm.
Oh boy.
So is this Replacements Associate?
Well, my friends call me Replacement Steve. Yeah, sometimes.
Your friends call you Replacement.
They do. Yeah.
Steve.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so I don't even want to know if that's associated with the Replacement song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, no, we're not going
to
talk about.
I haven't done it yet, but if you know if it comes to it, I'll point to it and say, "Look what Gary's got."
Stop it.
What?
Come on, Steve.
That is a song reference, Tom.
Yes.
Yeah.
Replacement song reference.
Yes. To one of their Kiss songs.
Well, yeah, it's one of their gutter rock songs. Mm-hmm. Yeah. One of their throwaways.
Yeah. They always had a song like Dose of Thunder or... Yeah. Right?
Maybe you could answer me this.
I'll try.
Why did they... There's several instances of them. The second song on couple records were mm-hmm. were not weak, but
sort of. Well, they build. I think it was probably some building up.
I'll buy.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Back and to back.
Yes.
What was the second song on All Shook Down?
Well, you stumped me. Replacement Steve.
Let's IMDb this.
Well, IMDb is not the place. It was an album, not a movie.
Sure it was.
I'm just having...
Wait, what do you mean?
All their records were movies.
All the Replacements albums?
Yeah.
No, they were albums.
Oh.
That's why they were... All their records were records.
No, but they're on those discs.
No, those are not DVDs.
Yeah, they're not DVDs.
Oh, no wonder they wouldn't play in my DVD player.
Yeah, that might have something to do with why they didn't... So you thought...
Well, now I feel bad because I caused such a scene every time I bought one.
Uh-huh.
I returned them.
You thought they were just movies that, for some reason, you bought a bum copy of the
movie. I did, yes. Yeah, I thought, man, I got some terrible luck.
And what would you think a Replacements movie would be? Like the movie for Pleased to Meet Me. What would that be?
Okay, well, all right. Exterior. Hand modeling school. Jeff Sorensen. He's teaching a class on hand modeling. And he looks out in the crowd of students and he says, "You, the young gutter snipe looking guy, come on up here." And it's Paul Westerberg.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Oh, you poor thing, your sleeve is torn. Let me shake your hand." And then, you know, and then they take the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, and then this guy, Alex Chilton, comes into frame.
Okay.
And then they talk a little bit. And then one of them says, I don't know. And then they just start talking about what they don't know.
And then
later on, one of them goes, "Man, I got some nightclub jitters, baby."
Replacement Steve.
And then the next scene, it's a dream sequence, and this one guy, he's on a ledge of a building.
Yeah, I wish he can't come out.
And then he wakes up and he goes, "Oh, never mind." And then the next scene is in a pool hall.
Okay.
And they're getting really muddy, and they're throwing mud at each other.
Uh-huh.
And then they make up, and they're drinking wine.
Ugh.
And then there's this thing in the air that they're walking through, and it's a skyway. And then they can't hardly wait to go back to this other place.
Okay.
Yeah.
And that's the end of the movie.
That's the end of the movie. End credits.
That's the dumbest thing I've ever heard.
It's not quite factual, I should say. I think Jeff Sorensen, the hand model, was just the brother of the photographer who took the cover. So I don't know if you're basing on that on, you know, actual factual things, but I think that's a stretch.
I don't know. Look, why are you guys grilling me? I'm just a lowly maintenance man sweeping. I didn't do anything to you guys.
No, you didn't say we did anything.
I'm sorry. No, I
why,
got,
yeah.
I'm just, I got temper problems. But I'll tell you, man, my life is back on track.
Really?
Thanks to my fiancé.
Okay.
Sydney Leathers.
Wait, who's your fiancé?
Sydney Leathers? Oh, you may have heard of her. She's in a movie. She's a movie star.
Wait, I watched this movie the other day, Wiener.
Yeah, yeah. She's the star of it.
No, it's a documentary. It's not exactly the... She's the woman who was sexting with Anthony Wiener... And then came forward and publicized their sects, and then she did a porn movie, I think, based on the exchanges with Anthony Wiener, and then confronted him at his election concession speech. She was gonna try to confront him at. And then I remember her running through a McDonald's trying to chase down Anthony Wiener, who was running from her.
Ooh.
That's your...
Ooh. Well, she didn't mention any of that. I haven't seen the movie. She didn't mention any of that. She just said that she was a star of this movie called Wiener that was just opening.
Mm-hmm.
So, ooh, we got to work through some stuff, I guess, before our wedding.
Uh-huh.
And we were hoping you were going to officiate the wedding.
You were hoping I would officiate your wedding?
Yeah.
Why?
Well, okay. You know, you're a big deal
mm-hmm.
here, and we love those impressions you do.
Yeah,
and,
well, okay.
And we were hoping, like, maybe you could do the ceremony as, I don't know, like Joe Namath or something. What would that be like if you were to officiate our wedding as Joe Namath?
Well, now you piqued my, I got to see. What would that be like? I think it would go, you're Steve.
Right, yeah.
And Sydney.
Sydney, yeah.
Okay. I think if I was officiating your wedding as Joe Namath, it would probably go a little something like, "Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today for the blessed union of replacement Steve and his beautiful, soon-to-be spouse, Sydney Leathers. And they are to be bonded in holy matrimony." That's what Joe Namath would sound like marrying you guys.
See, I think this is going to be great. I'm very excited about it.
Oh, so I'm actually going to... You're actually interested in me doing that?
I want you to do it. Of course I do.
Okay.
Of course I do.
Well, that's... Yeah. I guess we can talk about it.
Oh, wait, hang on.
What is that?
Oh, no.
Wait, that was your ringer?
Yeah. Yes, dear. No, dear. Yes, dear. No, dear. Maybe, dear. No, dear. Yes, dear. No, dear. No, dear. No. Yes, dear. No, dear. Okay, dear. Oh, boy.
What is it, replacement?
Nice job, Steve. You blew it.
What happened?
Well, I was about 4 weeks away, 4 weeks away from pulling a stepfather on my current family.
Mm-hmm.
And I had to open my big mouth and let the leathers out of the bag.
Mm-hmm. You were going to do what?
Pull a stepfather?
What does pull a stepfather mean?
You haven't seen The Stepfather?
The movie?
Yes.
Oh, I've seen the movie
The Stepfather. Oh, it's so good. It's so good. Remember what happens?
Yeah.
Basically, what happens is Terry O'Quinn, the star of the movie, he plays this guy who's insane.
Mm-hmm.
And he has a family that he is with. And he kills them, and then he goes to the next family that he's already set up,
mm-hmm.
and he has a family life with them, and then it just goes on and on like that for the whole.
So you were saying you were planning on you say I'm gonna pull a stepfather,
yeah,
which makes it sound a little tamer than what it actually is, which is.
Oh no, I wasn't gonna ice my current wife, Sheila Larson, and our kids Rieger and Habib.
Mm-hmm.
No, but. I was going to vanish from their lives quicker than you've been reaching for that voice modulator all night.
Hey, there's no voice modulator
sure there
back
is.
Here.
Bob, you've seen it, right?
I didn't want to say anything.
Yeah,
but
it's pretty obvious.
There's nothing here.
You're switching it on and off.
Just don't look, okay?
All right.
None of your business. Yeah.
Look, you're judging me, okay? Uh-huh. I don't like it. I'm not perfect.
Mm-hmm.
There was only one who ever was.
Okay. It seems to be another trend that's running through a lot of conversations I have. People really hammer me and then pull a religious quote when the heat's on them.
Right, right. Well, it's true, though. But, I mean... I thought I was safe, and how could I have imagined that my wife Sheila Larson would be tuning into this child CB radio show?
Mm-hmm. That's not.
I got
a child
caught.
CB
I don't like
radio
it.
Show.
Well, look, I gotta go. I gotta turn the old charm on for those two hags, or else I'm sleeping in the old Steve-mobile tonight.
Oh, that's charming.
Hey, do they sell erotic chocolates at the Quick Stop?
I don't think so.
Ugh. What here can I bring them to cause them to not be mad at me? What's that green thing, that puppet? What is that?
No, that's Vance. You can't take that.
Okay, well, can you give me, $10?
What about this?
Oh, what is it?
It's a Minions keyboard?
Yeah, that'll do.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Hello?
write you a letter tomorrow.
Ugh.
Tonight, I can't hold a pen. Someone's got a stamp that I can borrow.
Okay, enough.
I promise not to blow the address again. I can't wait.
Stop.
Hardly wait.
All right.
Lights that flash.
He's going into another verse.
Through the eve. No.
No, don't start. No.
Just give him. Brow. Well.
He's starting a whole new song.
It's a different song. Just give him the keyboard.
Down on all five.
All right, Steve.
Shows promise, Steve, yeah. But keep working at
get
it.
Get me
replacement
out of
Steve.
This stinking fresh air.
Get out.
How young are you?
Okay, go.
How old am I?
Oh.
It's making me question the whole last 8 years
in
I've spent.
The rain dancing in the night.
Yeah, that's what you spent the last 8 years working on.
I know. I think I blacked out after he told me he had that wimple tattoo. So
yeah, let's not talk about that. Thanks again for listening to Best Show Best, and I want to thank Martin DeGrell for supervising the episodes of Best Show Best, and of course. Much thanks to Jason Gore, Pat Byrne, Martine Sellis, Brendan McDonald, AP Mike, of course, John Worster, who else? Marcia Neumeier, and you, the Best Show listener. Thank you. And if you like this, check out the full show every Tuesday night from 9 p.m. to midnight at thebestshow.net and support the Best Show, patreon.com/thebestshow. Thanks so much for listening. Goodbye.